Mrs. Johnson.
May it please the Court, I'm Adam Merrill here on behalf of the defendant, Tracy Gray. I'm going to be addressing the reverse 404B or non-defendant 404B argument. Mr. Stengel will be addressing the sufficiency of the evidence argument, initially at least. Defendants are not disputing that at the closing of this real estate transaction, that they signed a loan application that contained false information. The only issue, really, at this stage is did they know the false information was included in those applications when they signed it? And it is our contention that defendants Tracy Gray and Samantha Johnson should have been allowed to introduce evidence that their mortgage broker, a man named Brian Bowling, duped other borrowers into signing false documents at their real estate closings. And there's three reasons why we believe the district court erred when it excluded that evidence. First, we believe that Rule 404B is not necessarily even triggered. Rule 404B would prohibit on its face the defendants from introducing evidence to show that Mr. Bowling had done something wrong, prior bad acts of his, to show that he'd done something wrong in connection with this closing. That wasn't the purpose. He admitted in his direct that he had not only engaged in fraud with this in this case, but in numerous other cases.
Now, it seems that the court did allow you to ask Bowling's former employee, Jakakowski, if Bowling kept his clients in the loop on what he was doing, you know, with their fraudulent loan applications, and he answered no. Why wasn't that enough to address your theory that Bowling duped other loan applicants?
Well, as you know, the government moved affirmatively in limine in advance of the trial. There was briefing on it. There was a final hearing. And what the defendants sought to do is they sought to bring in other borrowers that had been clients of Mr. Bowling that had been similarly duped into signing this. And because of the ruling in advance of trial, those folks weren't even at trial. They weren't even subpoenaed and available to be called as witnesses.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Your Honor.
Would the testimony of those actual clients be duplicative? I mean, you got it in. And wouldn't it violate, you know, the Rule 608 prohibition against extrinsic evidence in any case?
Well, let me take the latter point first. We didn't think of this as a 608 issue.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, the government wants to treat this as a 608 issue. We think this is a 404B issue, and more importantly, a reverse 404B issue where it's a different standard than what you're dealing with here. And in terms of the duplication, you know, we're talking about someone's liberty. And what the defendants wanted to do is introduce evidence that other borrowers had been in the same situation. The government basically said, how could they possibly not have known? That was their argument. You know, people went to a closing, they were walked through these applications, they were familiar with, they'd done prior closings, that was their entire case, is how could they not have known? Well, you know, other borrowers not, you know, having had the same experience would have helped establish their lack of intent.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, Judge Crabb allowed all of what you wanted except extrinsic evidence to prove the claim because of 608.
Well, she really said you can't bring these witnesses to trial. If they're prior borrowers who were defrauded by Mr. Bowling and showed up at a loan closing and signed applications that contained false information, and Mr. Bowling, he wasn't doing this because he wanted to get these people into homes. He was doing this because he figured out a way to make enormously large commissions on these types of deals. And the best way to do that is to make sure that, in our view, that the borrowers didn't know. So if those people had been allowed to come to trial, we think that could have made a difference. We don't know that it would have made a difference. We just don't believe it was fair for them to be, for the defendants to be prohibited from introducing that when the government was allowed to ask Mr. Bowling and the witness you just mentioned, did his clients that signed false applications know about it? And Mr. Bowling was allowed to answer that question.
You know, I have a very bottom line question for you, and it's this. Does your client really want a new trial on conspiracy and risk losing a pretty good deal on sentencing?
Your Honor, she does. She feels that she didn't get a fair shake at trial, and that the government excluded, or the court excluded, evidence at the instance of the government that should have been allowed.
Does she understand the possible ramifications, do you think?
Well, these are the types of things that keep lawyers up at night, and you certainly hope she does. And now, of course, you're making me wonder whether she really does. But I've been, given authority to make these arguments, and it's certainly her belief.
Because, we've seen some pretty terrible things.
Oh, I understand. I understand, Your Honor. But really what this is endemic of a problem that went on in this country for years. And that is that folks were put into loans that perhaps should have known better and perhaps shouldn't have signed what they signed. But it was the mortgage brokers and the mortgage companies that were pushing these and making it easier and easier and giving people the impression that if you just show up, you just sign this, you can get easy money. And this is a woman who's been a professional. She's not well-educated in terms of college degree, but she's worked in professional situations her whole life. I haven't talked to her in the last few months, but needless to say, this whole experience has made it much more difficult. And from her perspective, she's like, she may have made a dumb choice, may have exercised poor financial judgment, but her intent was to get her family in a home, and her intent was never to violate the law. And we just really think this is an example of the government overreaching, and then the government seeking to try people for crimes without allowing the defendants to put on a full and fair defense. We don't know how the jury would have reacted to this evidence. I can't begin to predict that. They may have still convicted her, but it's the court's job, in our view, to allow both sides to present, let it all come in. Okay, this isn't a regular 404B case involving a defendant where you've got real concerns from a constitutional perspective and a fairness due process perspective about whether that can be used to unfairly tarnish them. The court really erred on the side of
Mr. Merrill, this evidence you seek to bring in, is it your position that it speaks to innocence or jury nullification because these are minor violators compared to the individuals like Bowling that you referenced who are the drivers of these mortgage schemes? I mean, this is I appreciate your suggestion of prosecutorial discretion maybe not visited in the correct way here. But that's what you're really speaking to, aren't you? You just want a number of other people who also were about improper loan applications to say that they did it. Is that what this case would be about? So the jury would say, well, gee, the real bad guys are drivers, so we're going to nullify the charge, in effect. I mean, it doesn't speak to innocence, does it?
No, Your Honor, I think that mischaracterizes our argument with all due respect. And I think what's really happening here is that the defendants should have been permitted to show that other folks unknowingly signed loan applications that contained false information.
And here's the problem I have. We don't have any direct testimony that they didn't know what they signed. We've got the closing agent that testified she reviewed the loan application with Gray and Johnson. They initialed every page, each of the four pages. So if we put even Bowling aside, I don't see how bringing in all these other people affects that, what their actual knowledge was.
Well, Judge Williams, with our view is that if these closings were all done the same, and this is very routine. People sit down, and they shouldn't, but they sit down at closings all the time. They initial where they are supposed to initial. They sign where they're supposed to sign. They want to get this done as quickly as possible and move on. It's not what they're focused on and concerned with. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I can tell you that at my closings, I haven't paid as much attention. I'm going to pay more attention after having handled this case. But it's just something that is natural and doesn't happen. And what we believe happened is that the jury wasn't able to get an understanding, really, of how this worked. And the government was able to give them the impression that somehow these were unique defendants that didn't pay attention when everyone else paid exact attention. And we think if they would have been able to see what Brian Bowling did with virtually every client he had, that could have made a difference in their conclusions, not as to whether they were innocent, but whether they had the intent. They signed the document. That's undisputed. The document contained false information. That's undisputed. But whether or not they signed it, at the time they signed it, they knew that it contained false information. I'll reserve some time for rebuttal.
Mr. Stengel?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Pat Stengel. I represent Samantha Johnson. We have a very straightforward issue in front of the Court, and that is whether the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt at the trial the existence of the conspiracy. More specifically, whether there was an agreement between Samantha Johnson, Tracy Gray, and Brian Bowling to submit false information to the financial institution. And the government's evidence on this issue and in its Santiago proffer indicated to the district court we're going to prove this conspiracy essentially in two ways. One, through the testimony of Brian Bowling, and two, through the file of Platinum Concepts, his mortgage brokerage company. At the Santiago proffer, the court expressed its reservation as to whether the jury would find Mr. Bowling to be credible. She nonetheless allowed the government to put on its conspiracy case. Essentially, I guess I'd ask the court to look at the agreement portion of it in this way. Our argument is, and we can see, it's a steep uphill battle for a court to set aside credibility determinations made by a jury. However, we believe this is a unique case. If you look at Brian Bowling's testimony as a whole, before the trial, Bowling tells Special Agent Chris Nugath back in May of 2010 that he couldn't recall how he conveyed the information about the loan to Ms. Gray and Ms. Johnson. Lo and behold, at trial, he testifies that he had all these conversations with her, with them, about the falsities in these loan applications. The government puts a lot of emphasis on this email, Exhibit 10-4, from Samantha Johnson to Tracy Gray, where she says essentially, look, I want to try to help you out to get this loan. They're friends. She asks, can a co-applicant be a non-occupant? So essentially, right from the get-go, Bowling knew she had no intent to occupy the premises, that she was doing this to try to help out her friend Tracy Gray. Now, the government argues that that is proof of an overt act, that essentially that email back on October 3rd of 2006 constitutes an overt act of the conspiracy. But if you look at that email, there's nothing, that email says nothing about submitting false information. It says nothing about inflating their income or stating that they lived in one place and didn't own real estate and all the other number of falsities that unquestionably appeared in the final loan application at the closing in this case. But that document itself establishes, if in fact this is an overt act of the conspiracy, then the conspiracy had to have occurred either on that date of October 3rd, 2006, or before it. And there was a lot of testimony and I guess, argument at the trial about the meeting, which the government claimed occurred, which, or where, rather, the conspiracy was hatched. Now, the court is well aware you can't indifference or, you know, you can't innocently fall into a conspiracy. You can't stumble into a conspiracy. So that means, and the reason this meeting is so important is Bowling contended this meeting occurred 1 to 2 weeks prior to the closing in this case, which was on October 17th of 2006. But our contention is that his testimony is simply incredible, that it's exceedingly improbable that it occurred on that date. And the reason it's important is because it completely undermines Bowling's credibility. But if you look at that email, there's three pieces of evidence which suggest that had to be the date of this meeting. And that is the email, Exhibit 10-4, between Gray and Johnson about her seeing if she could be a co-applicant and not occupy the premises. And by the way, Bowling testified that he believed that she could. So it's an innocent question about, can I do this? So Bowling also conceded at trial that it's possible the first time he met was this date of 10-3-06. The reason this is all important, that it is so important, is because that's when this conspiracy had to hatch. And the government did not put on any evidence at trial. There were five people at this meeting, the two defendants, Brian Bowling, Shannon Hendricks, barman, and her father, Richard Hendricks. There's no evidence adduced at trial establishing that there were any discussions between any of the parties at that meeting about falsely submitting loan applications to try to get a loan. The government did not assert in the indictment that Barman or Hendricks were unwitting co-conspirators. I see my red light's on already, so.
That's your thought.
Let me wrap it up. The bottom line is they didn't put on any evidence as to an agreement. They try to argue that the final loan application signed at the closing was part of the agreement. But that's clearly a 1014 violation. We're not contending that it isn't. But that alone doesn't establish an agreement to do something illegal. There has to be proof independent of that, and our contention is that there isn't. So absent any questions, I'll ask the court to hopefully give us a little time on rebuttal.
Just to kind of piggyback on Judge Roedner's inquiry about sentencing, if you acknowledge it's a 1014 violation, do you really want to revisit this in light of the sentences that were imposed in this case?
I understand the court's concern, and I'm here because my client steadfastly believes in her innocence. But I just completely understand the court's position, and probably have some sleepless nights about it as well.
Well, you can always send a supplemental. I mean, you can talk to your clients.
Well, I assume you're here because your clients, as Mr. Merrill said, you've reflected on.
Right. I mean, I'm happy to revisit that. I appreciate the court's concern.
I don't want you sleepless.
You want me to sleep?
I now have people wanting to sit down, people sleepless. I may go home.
Can't go home yet.
That may be a little bit of a hyperbole, Your Honor, but I understand the court's concern.
I would thank you at the end anyway for your service, but it's just to confirm that you've reflected on that with counsel. That's just an inquiry we've made. We're not asking you to revisit.
No,
it's not a command.
No,
I understand.
You know, if you want to talk to your clients and you want to send something, you know, withdrawing arguments, you always can. But right. No. We don't give advice.
No, I don't take it that way. Thank you very much.
Mr. Graber?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan Graber. I represent the government. I was the AUSA that handled the trial down below.
What is the government's best evidence of agreement to file the false loan documents. I agree that there's enough probably to prove the substantive crime, but what is there in addition to the substantive crime that proves the agreement? I see plenty of agreement that they wanted to secure a loan, but where's the evidence that they agreed he could use fraud to secure the loan? Was there any evidence here that at the meeting with the home builders to discuss the loan, there was any discussion of the falsehoods on the application?
There was plenty, yes, Your Honor, there was. Brian Bowling is the main witness that provided that evidence, and he testified at trial about various conversations that he had with both defendants over the phone, where he went over with them the parameters of the loan and how they were going to have to get the loan and the application and how it would work. There was also an evening meeting 1 to 2 weeks before the closing where he went through the particular loan that they agreed on that was approved, which is the 50-30 loan, where he went through the details of that loan with the defendants. But he testified that there were numerous conversations that he had with the defendants over the phone where he explained to them, this is what we're going to need to do, falsify. we're going to put you both down as you're both living together. You're both going to buy the home together. You're both together are making $11,000 a month and are going to pay the mortgage together, all of which was false. The reality was that Tracy Gray and her boyfriend, Vincent Anderson, were going to live in that home. Together, they made about $60,000 a year, and they were going to buy a $322,000 home. And they tried, Tracy Gray tried to present that first to Mr. Bowling, and he ran it through, and they didn't qualify. Mr. Vincent Anderson had bad credit. Then she tried her brother, Michael Pine, and that didn't work. And then we have the email from Samantha Johnson where she says, well, I'll stand in and be the co-borrower if that works. That is, in essence, the case. She's acting as a nominee for Mr. Vincent Anderson, and the bank never knew that. And that's the agreement where they're going to tell the bank, guess what, bank? It's Vince and Tracy that are going to live there, and it's Vince and Tracy that are going to pay the mortgage. But we're going to tell you guys that it's Tracy and Samantha. And that's what they sent up to the bank. That got approved. And, of course, they lasted a couple years, and then it went under because they couldn't pay the mortgage and was foreclosed.
Why is it fair to argue that Bowling was not on trial and so his knowledge and intent and plan were not at issue? He was a member of the conspiracy. If he's part of the illegal agreement with the defendants, then why would his intent and plan not be entirely relevant to the defendant's understanding of the deal? I can see your argument if this was simply the substantive offense, but they were also convicted of conspiracy.
They were convicted of conspiracy, correct, Your Honor. Here's what I was trying to get at with the motion in limine. What they wanted to do was parade witnesses, other borrowers. They wanted to parade other borrowers to go in front of the jury and say, Brian Bowling filled out false loan application with me, and I was duped. I didn't know about it. And that, Your Honor, is not relevant. Having all those people get up there and say, well, I was duped, well, big deal. How does that show that Tracy and Sam were duped? The only people that can talk about whether they were duped were Tracy and Sam, and they decided not to take the stand. So it's not relevant to have this parade of witnesses come up there and say, well, I was duped by Bowling, therefore they must have been duped. Because I guess under their theory, the opposite should be true then too. I should be able to bring in a bunch of Brian Bowling clients to say, well, I was in a conspiracy with Brian. He filled out a false loan application for me, and I was in on it with them, and I'm guilty. Therefore, they're guilty too. Because if I knew, then they knew. There's a disconnect there. That's why Judge Crabb said, look, it's propensity evidence. You can't bring that in and say it's propensity, and there's not a non-propensity purpose.
I'm not sure they were. See, I think there was a lot. It just seems to me that there was a lot of confusion there because the judge was talking about propensity, but I don't know that that's what they were trying to show. They were trying to show other people were duped, and so they could have been duped as well.
Correct, and that's where their argument breaks down. Because what I did is I filed a motion in limine saying don't bring it in under 608B. You can cross Brian Bowling about it all day long, But you can't bring in the extrinsic evidence. That's pretty clear under 608B. So then at the final hearing, they did a back and pivoted and said, well, wait a minute, how about under 404B to show Brian's plan, intent, and knowledge? Well, Brian isn't on trial. His plan, intent, and knowledge aren't at issue. What's at issue is the intent and knowledge of the two defendants. And they didn't make the connection, and that's why I'm arguing this reverse 404B. They're bringing it up for the first time on appeal. They didn't bring that up in front of Judge Crabb. When they say that Judge Crabb used the wrong legal standard to rule on the reverse 404B, she didn't use the reverse. They never brought it up. They never argued it to her. They never brought the standard up to her. So that's why she never made a ruling on reverse 404B. But the reverse 404B doesn't even apply, Your Honors. It doesn't apply, and I tried to cite the cases for you in the brief. That concept exists when you're trying to say, look, it's not me, it's somebody else. If you look at those cases, they deal with mistaken identity. It's those guys that robbed the bank, not me, because they have that distinctive MO of robbing banks and wearing, you know, yellow hoodies and something. And therefore, you know, the fact that this bank got robbed by a guy with a yellow hoodie means that I didn't do it, other people did it. That's not the case here, because these two women went to the closing. They filed a false loan application. The issue is intent. Did they know? And the fact that, again, that's where the disconnect works. Just because other people didn't know doesn't mean that these two didn't know. And that's why the reverse 404B breaks down. And so that's why we're saying Judge Crabb properly precluded it under 608B. And then when they brought a 404B argument saying, well, wait a minute, it should come in under Bowling for his intent, knowledge, and plan, it doesn't, Your Honor, because that's not relevant, because he wasn't the one on trial. These two were. Unless the court has any other questions, I don't have anything else.
Judge Williams, do you have any questions?
Oh, I don't.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Graber. Mr. Merrill.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is clear in this case that the government moved under 404B in addition to under 608. It is also clear that we argued, the defendant's counsel argued for a reverse 404B or non-defendant 404B standard. They didn't use the term reverse. We will concede that. But this court has pointed out you don't need to use that term. It's the same as non-defendant. And Ms. Gray's counsel below very clearly said, let's assume Bowling didn't tell the other borrowers what he was doing either until they got into the closing, and said sign the documents, and these other borrowers relied on him and had no idea what he was doing. So that's exactly the type of thing we argued for. There's not really a dispute about that if you look closely at the record. And I never thought I'd see the day when a government lawyer would argue that you can't prove intent with circumstantial evidence. He's saying the only person that could prove intent is Tracy and Sam. Well, circumstantial evidence comes up, including in criminal cases, against defendants all the time. And so it's only fair that defendants ought to be able to show other people in similar situations. That's what the reverse 404B cases show. We understand the Seventh Circuit hasn't come out that way yet, but the Seventh Circuit has certainly adopted the standard and cited other cases where that where decisions have been reversed, and we would respectfully urge the court to do so here.
What about just a single act of the inflation of income as to the question of intent?
Well, the issue is did they know that the loan application contained inflated income? Brian Bowling prepared those loan applications, and there's no evidence they were ever given to Tracy Gray or Samantha Johnson prior to the closing. So the question is did they sit down at the closing table, flip through it, understand that the income was inflated, and then sign knowing that it was false?
No.
Go ahead.
What about these telephone calls?
Well, Your Honor,
the jury believed Mr. Bowling.
I'm glad you brought that up because my light's red and now I can answer, but I wouldn't have had time otherwise. Mr. Bowling, if you look at the record, and we pointed this out in our reply, he doesn't talk about any specifics of what he said to them. He makes a vague general statement that I told them and they knew what was going on. He doesn't give dates. He doesn't say who was on the phone. He doesn't say what was discussed.
Yeah, but was he asked?
Yeah, well, we both
he was asked, and he couldn't even pinpoint when these supposed when he supposedly told them whether it was in the month before the closing or not.
Well, and then the jury heard that, right?
Absolutely, the jury heard that, and we're not suggesting that additional evidence about Mr. Bowling should have come in. We're saying that maybe perhaps the jury could have come to a different decision had they heard about these other borrowers, and that, I mean, this was a fraud mill. Mr. Bowling went away for about 60 months. He got 13 months knocked off because of his cooperation in this case. But everything he was doing was fraudulent. And if the jury had understood that numerous other borrowers had been duped into signing documents when they didn't know they were false, they might have believed that the defendants here.
But they did have that evidence with Mr. Jakubowski or...
I understand, Your Honor, that one person testified to that. Mr. Bowling contradicted that, and the witnesses that we would have brought to trial were never permitted to show up.
Would your position be, Mr. Merle, that if you had brought those kind of witnesses, the government then could bring a half dozen of people who said they did know, let's say they were immunized, would that would be what we would have before us probably, the government... countering your reverse 404B by a half a dozen immunized individuals similar to these defendants saying, I knew I made a mistake.
Well, what Mr. Bowling was talking about is not exactly that scenario. I thought he was saying that it would be okay to introduce evidence that Mr. Bowling, in fact, had told them, and that would be to show that he'd, in fact, told Ms. Gray and Ms. Johnson. That would be improper. That would be a different standard. There's two different standards here. In the scenario you just spun out, I suppose you could end up with a mini trial, which most judges I can't imagine would allow. They'd probably set some limits on it, but certainly the government would have been free to cross-examine and I suppose introduce extrinsic evidence about whether these folks knew.
The only reason I raise it, I suspect that in an experienced trial judge like Judge Grab, she may have been reflecting on that the possibility of if it went the way you suggest should have gone with further witnesses.
If you read the final hearing transcript, there's no doubt Judge Crabb was concerned about how to place limits on this. And in our view, she certainly didn't apply the same standard that this court has suggested she apply in reverse 404B cases. And that's what we think erred. We think that because of that, the defendants were forced to fight with one hand tied behind their back. That's not fair, particularly in a criminal case. And we would ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. All right, thanks to all of counsel. Mr. Merrill and Mr. Stengel, you have the additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment in this case. Thank you.